This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. With a flurry of other bills out of the way, from right to work to abortion, state lawmakers settled in for the main event this week, the budget. Arguments were heated as Republicans presented cuts in areas from health and human services to the university system. Meanwhile, a proposed $88 million spending reduction for the Department of Transportation had House Democrats like Daniel Eaton warning of dire consequences.
It is going to mean basically the highway department no longer exists. They are virtually shuttering the doors of DOT. They will not have plowing, they will not be able to fix potholes, they will not be able to do road maintenance.
And speaking of budgets, the Department of Corrections has struggled to stick to its spending plan for a new women's prison. Jeff Lyons is a Corrections Department spokesman.
The project is costing more than it originally anticipated to cost, and so we now have to look at our options. And in order to make sure we come in as close to budget as possible, we'd have to delay the construction by a period of time.
Also in the Granite State this week, the latest round of visits from likely presidential contenders included Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who caught some flack for supposedly scaring a little girl by saying that the world is on fire, and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who once again defended his support of the Common Core standards.
I've learned, though, that because something's controversial, or you have a view that, you know, the narrative, the so-called political narrative has been built up, you don't abandon your core beliefs. You go persuade people, as I've tried to do right now, about why I'm for higher standards.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the roundup this week are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. And Josh, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, let's start with the budget, Josh. And before we get into some of that interesting stuff that happened on the gas tax this week, just remind us how this works. So Governor Hassan presented her budget in mid-February, then what?
Then that proposal moves to the House Finance Committee. It is filtered down into various subcommittees. They take chunks of the budget, work them over, revise, reject, adopt components of a governor's proposal, goes to the full Finance Committee. That gets voted on, heads to the House floor, and then, you know, April 1st or so, it has to move on to the Senate and the process begins anew.
So it's a long process. So that's what we saw this week, Josh, these various finance subcommittees working on their particular area, whether it's transportation, health and human services and so forth.
Precisely. And they, you know, started on the governor's plan, which you may recall was $11.5 billion in total spending, which was around a 6.5% increase over the current budget.
That's the starting point.
That's what she proposed.
So when you see headlines, Josh, you know, cuts of X amount in the budget or whatever, this is all just working its way through the process. Nothing's final yet.
Oh, absolutely not. And most of the time when people are talking about cuts, it's cuts based on the new spending proposed by the governor. So it is not necessarily an absolute cut in spending that's happening currently, but a cut from what the governor proposed.
From what the governor proposed, which we covered extensively last month. Some interesting politics this week. Dean, what are you seeing over there at the House?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, Josh described this process, and it feels almost a bit like an ideological exercise. So, the House, the Republican budget writers in the House are working from a set of estimates about revenue for the future that is lower than what Governor Hassan worked into her budget. So they're working from a somewhat different set of numbers, and you know they're kind of going through the budget, and the transportation proposed transportation cuts are the cuts that are getting the most attention. But in general, you know, the House budget writers are looking, Republican budget writers are looking at, you know, cuts maybe 150 million or several hundred million over the entire reach of the budget.
The 2 year cycle.
Yeah, over the 2 year cycle. But what's so interesting is at the same time we're hearing individuals say these cuts are necessary, you're hearing Republicans in the Senate. And even some Republicans in the House say, well, don't worry. These aren't really this isn't really going to happen. It's probably going to change. The Senate says, well, we're going to start from scratch. So, you know, so it almost has a feel of kind of like an ideological exercise. You know, our revenue, you know, Republicans are saying our revenue estimates are tighter. We need to cut more from the budget. Governor Hassan's budget spends too much, this 6%, roughly 6% increase. So here are all the ways in which we're going to cut it. But don't worry, because it's probably not really going to end up this way. We're still early in the process. So, you know, maybe it helps for kind of positioning with constituencies or making a larger fiscal point about the need to cut. It certainly has gotten Governor Hassan out there saying that these cuts are too extreme. But again, it's all this sort of hypothetical exercise. It's going to be a while before we actually know what the reality is going to be. And I think I've found that fascinating to hear Republicans say we need to cut. But don't worry, because nothing's final yet. So we may not actually cut. It's fascinating.
Waiting for the Senate to jump in. Yeah. What is the Senate saying about all this so far, Josh? I mean, it's not their turn yet, but, you know, sometimes you get comments from senators.
Well, yesterday the Senate had Senate Bill 1 and 2 before them, which were reductions to the business profits tax and the business enterprise tax on New Hampshire's two main business taxes. And as they were debating those, and those passed along party lines of Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed, there was talk of, well, if we do this, it's just going to add pressure to the budget because, you know, over these rates would be ratcheted down over a number of years. That this would, you know, the estimates of the Department of Revenue is that it would be at least be $140 million of lost revenue. They said, well, we took an unworkable budget 2 years ago and we made it work. We worked together. And the implication was, you know, we can largely ignore what's going to happen in the House once the budget's in our hands. You know, we can do what we will, and the track record would suggest that the Senate budget process tends to be closer to the final product, and part of that is that they are closer to the time period when the budget would take effect, so they have better ability to forecast revenues. And you know, right now there's a big push and pull between Republicans and the governor's office over how optimistic one should be about the future. The governor reiterates again and again that, you know, we don't need to budget like we're in a recession because, you know, the unemployment rate's dropping. There are indicators that the economy is improving. Republicans, meanwhile, say, you know, we need to be prudent. We don't want to spend money we don't have. At the same time, it's interesting in the House, one of the tweaks that Republicans made to the budget was to project a decrease in Medicaid caseloads based on the idea that the economy was getting better. Therefore, there would be fewer people in need of Medicaid. So, you know, this push and pull isn't going to continue, and people aren't always consistent.
That's interesting. So everybody's sort of looking ahead and trying to make their own prediction and say, my prediction is more on base than the other person's prediction.
Yeah, and this is nothing new. This happens every cycle, and Particularly in the House, Republicans, you know, spend a lot of time talking about the prudence of Ways and Means Chairman Norm Major, and they, you know, tout him as somebody who can be trusted on revenues. The Democrats, meanwhile, say, you know, the governor's estimates are fine and we're a product of a revenue estimating panel.
But you're right.
We'll see when we get to the Senate.
And we know that, like a lot of things in life, the legislative process is subject to human nature, and the Senate is up against the calendar, the June 30th deadline for having the budget. So, you know, people are a lot more likely to cut deals when they see the final clock winding down.
Everybody loves
it. It happens in the U.S. Congress, and it happens in the state legislature as well. So I think Josh is right. I think we'll get much closer to that deadline. We'll get a better sense of what will happen. But kind of the hypothetical nature of the spending cuts discussion, I think, again, has been really interesting to watch.
All right. So that's the political framework, guys. I do want to ask you some specifics, especially about the Department of Transportation, given everybody's interest in roads and bridges, especially after this tough winter. Let me also invite our listeners to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Josh Rogers is here along with Dean Spiliotis, and we're covering some of the big stories of the week around the Granite State. You can join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Josh, just clear this up for me, please. We hear concern about the state of our roads and bridges. Then we hear about cuts in the Department of Transportation budget. Then we hear Democrats saying, you can't do this. It'll ruin our infrastructure. Then we hear Republicans coming back and saying, don't worry about it. We're going to raise gas taxes.
That's a reasonable gloss on some of what's been said. Overall, the proposal in the House has been, you know, $88 million worth of reductions. About $68 million of that would go to personnel. $20 million of that would be across the board. The rationale is to address gaps in the highway fund. DOT says if the cuts take effect, we're talking about the loss of about 700 jobs, which would be about half the department's workforce. Democrats say these cuts would mean that cities and towns would need to take over responsibility for 2,500 miles of road and 1,000 bridges. Some of this cut is due to the House Finance Committee's rejection of Governor Hassan's proposal to bump up auto registration fees by about 35%. Some Republicans have proposed that they're going to make up for this loss by proposing a gas tax when the budget hits the floor, a gas tax increase of 7 or 8 cents. That would predict to generate $49 million a year, which would be roughly the same thing as the auto registration fee increase.
Were you surprised by this, Josh? I mean, this proposal was made quite openly by Neil Kirk, a fiscal conservative chair of the House Finance Committee. And he said, yeah, you know, we probably need to raise gas tax. Were you surprised by that?
A little bit. And it remains to be seen whether this can pass. This is a floor amendment. One argument that can be made against it is, like, this isn't even had a public hearing, which is a rationale for rejection, for rejecting a lot of things in the House. And it's unclear, you know, it's going to be sponsored by three members of the Finance Committee. It's quite unclear that, and even if it gets through the House, the reception it gets in the Senate is, you know, Chuck Morris, Senate President, is, you know, vehemently opposed to gas tax increases. He fought the 4.2 cent increase that came across last year. We've got a little different mix in the Senate, so we don't really know where that's headed. But Senator Morris is clearly sending signals that he's not wild about this. And, you know, it will be interesting. You could argue that the gas tax is a fairer way to raise money for roads and bridges than an auto registration fee, in that it's somewhat
heavy
pegged to use.
Pay it more.
But, you know, it's also important to remember that the 4.2 cent increase that passed or took effect last year was dedicated to roads and bridges and not the operating budget. So you know, we'll see where this goes. I mean, obviously people are interested in roads, and this we're going to keep on hearing about this.
Okay, Dean, real quick, your thoughts. I mean, that 4.2 cent increase that Josh mentioned was a tough slog last time around.
And I think it was the first increase in something like 18 years, almost 20 years. So as Josh said, we've seen signals from the Senate that it's pretty unlikely. And again, it was a little surprising to have the Transportation Committee, you know, recommend these $88 million in cuts and then have Neil Kirk say, well, we're going to go for a gas tax. We haven't heard about that from Governor Hassan. She has pushed the cigarette tax increase and the voter vehicle registration, but it's uncertain to say the least.
All right. Well, coming up, trouble with the budgeting for a new women's prison that hasn't been built yet. We'll find out more. Stay with us for more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. We'll check in now with our Short March Fund Drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, when we cover some of the top stories of the week. A little bit later, we'll look at students in Manchester and two other districts taking the wrong version of the new Common Core aligned test. Right now, though, we're going to turn to another story that made news this week in the Granite State, and that's a new state prison for women. With us now on the women's prison story is NHPR's Emily Corwin. She's been covering this. And Emily, what did we learn this week about this prison?
Right. So in a committee hearing, it became clear that this new prison for women, which already broke ground, wouldn't come in. Not only would it come in $12.5 million over budget, but that it would also be completed a year later than anticipated.
Wow. So big news around this. They've already broken ground, as you say, behind the men's prison on State Street in Concord.
That's right.
Yeah. So how did this new prison come about? Who came up with the idea of building a new prison for women?
Yeah. So really briefly, basically the state has to provide male and female inmates equal access to prison programming. And because the female inmates had been and are housed at the old Goffstown jail, there really isn't enough room there for them even all to sleep adequately, let alone have vocational and educational options. So the female inmates sued in a class action lawsuit, and the settlement was basically this new women's prison.
Wow, and this has been going on for a long time, because I remember a conversation about this years and years ago.
Yeah.
So the number that's always been thrown around with this prison is $38 million. That's no longer accurate?
Right. So Administrative Services says that, you know, they're the folks that are responsible for anticipating costs like this, that the state needs 113,000 square feet of prison. That's what they know. And initially they estimated that at minimum that would cost $44 million. They say lawmakers pushed them down to 38. They thought they could probably make that work. And that's what the legislature appropriated, $38 million. Now they say they're looking at $50, even $55 million for this prison.
Why is it so much more than was anticipated? Why all this bumping around with the numbers, Emily?
Yeah, so this is interesting. I did a story on the design process for the prison last year. And during reporting that story, I learned that while researching prison design, the Department of Corrections, and especially the then Assistant Commissioner Bill McGonigal, who's since retired, they became really enamored with architecture that tries to create a therapeutic environment for inmates. And that includes not just like natural light and open spaces, but actually separate buildings, kind of like a campus, so that you would leave your residential building in order to go to classes or meals, that kind of thing. And so that's how the architects ultimately designed the prison. That's the design they have. It turns out now that this campus concept is more expensive than they expected. And by last fall, you know, they knew that they were looking at $50 million rather than $38, and then they put it out to bid. And what happened is that they found out, you know, the bids came in and be more like $55 million.
And the contractor said, no way, we can't create this nice therapeutic environment at the $38 million
right.
level that you've put out for us. So why didn't they anticipate, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, that this more therapeutic design, more campus-style design would be more expensive than your traditional prison?
I think that's a really good question. I don't know how much money was spent designing that prison that will no longer likely be built. But, you know, Administrative Services says that they're not sure whether the bids they didn't get enough bids as they expected. They got very few bids. And they don't know whether that's because, you know, the market's really heated up for construction and everybody's busy, or they think maybe something about this design was off-putting, seemed undoable, and if they do a new design, maybe they'll get a more competitive set of bids. So,
wow. They are going to build this thing, though, Emily.
Yeah, that's the plan.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
That's NHPR's Emily Corwin updating us on some struggles with the new women's prison and getting that built. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Join us with your questions and comments as we cover some of the big news items of the week. 1-800-892-6477. And Josh Rogers, Dean Spiliotis, it seems like no matter what we talk about these days, it's budget related. Josh Rogers, other big budget items that also came up this week?
Well, certainly the Health and Human Services budget, which you know, makes up about half of state spending, is something that, you know, always gets a lot of attention at this time of year. And there are some reductions that have been proposed to programs. Substance abuse is something that has come up. You know, interestingly, though, there's some proposed tweaks to the Medicaid enhancement tax that lawmakers ultimately decided to reverse course on for fear that it ran afoul of the settlement the state reached with all but one hospital in the state. And so that adds about $40 million back to the budget that had been removed. And so, you know, overall, you know, Health and Human Services is something that's going to get a lot of attention as we move forward.
Yeah, I got an email on something concerning Health and Human Services. Let me share it with you, and then I have a question for you too, Dean. This is from Dennis in Barrington. He says, Republicans in committee voted to end the expansion of Medicaid after 2016. This is the New Hampshire Health Protection Plan, a.k.a. Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. So Dennis says they claimed it was a, quote, disincentive for people to work. He says, but the expansion of Medicaid covers people who are the working poor. Ending this program, he says, would be turning down the 90% of federal funding that would otherwise come to the state to help these people afford health care. Dennis, thanks for the email. Dean, we should definitely talk about this. The whole Obamacare, Medicaid expansion and so forth is part of this budgeting process that we're in now.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, that the current Medicaid expansion, which I think covers people earning up to 138% of poverty level. So that was the reference to the working poor. It's set to sunset at the end of 2016, and I think it's been kicked down the road a little bit to wait and see what happens. But again, the underlying argument of Republicans is that the Obama administration funding will ratchet down slowly over time, and the concern that we typically hear in state legislatures or from governors who oppose it is the danger of becoming an unfunded mandate, that at some point the federal government no longer funds it, but you already have people in the program, and then you have to come up with the money somewhere else. So this will continue to be a big issue until we see what happens at the end of 2016.
Go ahead, Josh.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's important to remember that when this passed, Democrats controlled the House, Republicans controlled the Senate.
Right.
House Republicans are on record voting against this and opposing it. A deal was struck in the Senate, particularly between Senators Morse, the Senate President, and Jeb Bradley, the Majority Leader, reached a deal with the governor's office on the architecture of this program, which they were always loath to call Medicaid expansion. It was always the New Hampshire Health Protection Plan. It's unique and it's ours, and it relies more heavily on private insurers than a traditional expansion of Medicaid. And it'll be interesting to see how those folks handle this when it gets there. I don't think people are shocked that the House is proposing to undo Medicaid expansion, and the politics of this will be interesting when you have, 40,000 people who have signed up and what to do with those people. It's fair to say a lot of people who end up on Medicaid, I mean, this is something that comes up every budget cycle, like how many of those people are active voters? But this is something that Governor Hassan dearly wants to keep, and this is something that Republican leaders in the Senate stuck their neck out on a bit. And whether or not they choose to take this up this year as part of the budget, there's been some indication that they'd be more inclined to wait till next year to deal with this. It remains to be seen what they do, but they've voted to lay some Medicaid expansion related. They've voted to lay a bill on the table. When they choose to take off the table, or if they ever do, we'll see. But this is one of the more interesting parts of the budget. It affects, thousands of people, and the politics around this, local, regional, national, are naughty.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did want to ask you about the Senate, so I'm glad you said that, Josh. Speaking of political forces that might align in favor of this, the Business Industry Association, right, Josh, is in favor of this Medicaid expansion
Sure. I mean, and, they're also in favor of a lot of things that, might make it hard to fund some of this. So it all depends. And, they don't run the world. There's some interesting coalitions here. And as you look at it in the context of one group of people who definitely also like Medicaid expansion are the hospitals.
Employers in the state.
And, this push and pull over the settlement agreement on the Medicaid enhancement tax. And it might be interesting to see how that plays out down the line.
There's a lot there. Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
One of the big underlying issues in this whole discussion of proposed budget cuts is the issue of downshifting. You're going to hear that word a lot in the coming months. If you cut back on mental health services, drug and alcohol programs, nursing homes, emergency shelter funding, all those kinds of things, road maintenance, et cetera, a lot of that gets pushed down to the municipal level, which means property taxes likely go up. And that kind of, I think, at some level kind of drives the politics at the grassroots. So, that's what you're going to hear a lot of Democrats say, that this is going to downshift the costs to the local level. So that's going to kind of be in the mix there as well.
Okay. Well, and gentlemen, I want to turn away from budgetary stuff for the moment. Just one more quick question for you, though, Josh. Are there other major budgetary items that we haven't talked about yet? We've talked about health and human services, the prison, transportation. Anything else that's sort of going to be talked about a lot, or that is going to be really on the table for lawmakers?
I mean, we'll see when it hits the floor, and we'll see when – I mean, Dean's made this point, but I think it's really worth – it's often when it gets to the Senate that we really find out how this is going to go. And it'll be interesting to watch how the Senate deals with what is a somewhat fractious House majority still. But it's also interesting if you look at how the budget, as it's coming out of the House, the leadership was, Speaker Jasper and his regime were elected with majority Democratic support. And, one thing that people were looking at is like, well, when they get in there, are they essentially going to be, governing with Democrats or governing with the Republican Party, a lot of the members who wanted Bill O'Brien to be Speaker again. And, you know, I don't think anyone would consider what they've done. You know, we'll see what happens with the gas tax. But this is a pretty conservative budget coming out of the House Finance Committee.
Yeah, it's interesting. OK, so, Dean, another question that I really did want to get to you. After years and years of talking about the Common Core here in New Hampshire, and we've done a bunch of shows and so forth. Jeb Bush was in the state talking about Common Core this week. Students across New Hampshire began taking the test this week. And in a few districts, including Manchester, our biggest district, they took the wrong test. Not an auspicious beginning, Dean. What happened?
Yeah, a little bit of an administrative snafu. Yeah. You know, people often think the Common Core is this kind of federally imposed curriculum. It's really something that was developed in the states and adopted on a state-by-state state-by-state basis. You know, here in New Hampshire, different districts make a decision about whether or not to adhere to this curriculum, but all districts have to take this smarter balanced assessment, which replaces the kneecaps for people who have kids. They've heard their kids talk about kneecaps for years. These
New England Common Assessment Program.
I couldn't even tell you. All I know is that the kneecaps are coming.
Yeah. My kids call it the New England Child Abuse Program, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's seven or eight hours of testing, I think. So, you know, so we're switching over, even though it varies from district to district about whether or not you adhere to the curriculum, everybody is switching over to this common test, the Smarter Balanced Assessment Test. And apparently three districts, Manchester, Gorham, and Barrington, used a practice test instead of the actual exam. And there are, I guess, other districts that still want to be able to use the practice test. And it literally came down to, on the computer screen, choosing the interim test rather than summative test.
So
they literally
just
clicked on the wrong
drop-down
test.
Menu.
Wrong, on a drop-down menu, literally. I mean, all this stuff is done on computer nowadays. So, you know, it was just sort of an administrative hiccup. But as we know, this is a very contentious issue. Presidential candidates talk about it all the time. It gets conflated with kind of the whole federal role in education. But these are really discussed at the state level.
All right. Let's take a call, gentlemen. This is Bob in Amherst. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious if there are any state legislators working on relieving property tax owners, of people that own homes.
Okay.
In the state of New Hampshire.
Sounds like you're looking for that, Bob.
Yeah. Yes, because it seems like the real tax burden falls on the homeowners and throughout the state.
Okay. And, Bob, we're heading into a break, so we will tackle that question after a short break. Thanks for calling in. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're checking in now with our super short March fund drive. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In a moment, we'll turn to presidential politics and who was in the Granite State this week. But before we do, Dean Spiliotis, I did want to let you answer our caller's question that came in just before the break. Bob in Amherst said, are any state lawmakers working on property tax relief?
Yeah, and it's obviously a timely question. I mentioned the issue of downshifting costs to municipalities before the break. The answer is basically no. You know, when we do hear about property taxes at the state level, it's often in conjunction with the discussion of a state income tax. That if you know, people who support a statewide income tax argue, if we had the income tax, that would take some of the pressure off of property taxes.
Mark Fernald made that argument
absolutely,
a decade ago.
Absolutely, but typically no. This is something that is fought at the local level. We've just gone through a fascinating town meeting season in which multi-million-dollar public works projects in the various communities, you know, safety and security facilities, new town halls, all those kinds of structures, were all basically defeated because people are pushing to ease the burden of property taxes or to keep them from going any further. And, you know, that really is kind of the bottom line in terms of grassroots politics. We just saw this vote last night in Bow over a new $5 million complex there. It was defeated. Tremendous turnout. And that is a function of people at the local level, the grassroots, standing up for what they want, which is lower property taxes. So unfortunately, it's not typically a priority of state legislators unless they're talking about an income tax and or downshifting costs to the local level.
All right, Bob, thanks for joining us. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we wrap up some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Josh Rogers, here's an email from Sean in Meredith. He says, please inform the listeners what the gas tax, parentheses, road toll, state and federal total, 42 cents, means to them and actual cost to them. The average driver in New Hampshire drives about 14,575 miles. That equates to 62 cents a day and only about $225 a year. That's a very low number, shouldn't be discussed as a hardship. Sean says this is the bargain of the century. And this is, as a state and a country, we need to wake up and invest in this important asset. So there's a shout out for a higher gas tax. He's saying it's a bargain.
Well, I mean, this is an argument that comes up when people say, would you rather pay that along the way, or would you rather, you know, run into a huge pothole and have to get your car fixed? And the argument about this is not new, but you know, this is something, you know, the lobbying interests against raising the gas tax have been very potent through the years, and businesses and truckers will say that this is just going to add to the cost of everything down the line. You know, last year there was a 4.2 cent increase, first one in a long time. We'll see what happens when this hits the House floor. It's really not clear at this point.
Well, I did want to ask you, Josh, and you too, Dean, about some of the presidential politicking around the state this week in the few minutes we have left. Just give us the list, Josh. Who was here this week?
Well, Donald Trump. If he was here last night. Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Rick Perry were here last week. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul.
Maybe a better question would be who wasn't here.
Rand Paul is here today. A lot of Republicans I talked to are interested to see. Lindsey Graham was here. George Pataki has been here a lot. A lot of Republicans I've talked to are interested to see what John Kasich is like when he arrives. He's coming, I think, next week.
Congressman,
and
Ohio
governor of Ohio. It's been very busy on the Republican side, and on the Democratic side, much less so. Bernie Sanders was here, too, this week. And, you know, sooner or later, you know, Hillary Clinton presumably is going to show up. Whether or not, you know, she needs to, you know, remains to be seen.
All right. I want to ask Dean about Hillary Clinton in just a moment. But let's take another call, gentlemen. Roger's calling from Stratham. Hi, Roger. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. I wanted to point out that Lindsey Graham and George Pataki are two Republicans who may have different views on the issue of climate change and positions on solutions. Pataki originated the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. Go ahead, Roger.
And well, yeah, I just wanted to ask if panelists and you think that the media will be, particularly in New Hampshire media, asking candidates about their solutions and how they propose to address it, and even what their takeoff is on science.
Okay, thank you very much, Roger. And, you know, this is one of the many issues, Dean Spiliotis, that we'll be talking to these candidates about. I had forgotten. He's absolutely right. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative started with George Pataki.
Yeah, and George Pataki, former governor of New York State, viewed as kind of a more moderate centrist Republican than some of the others in the field. You know, candidates are always asked about their views on climate change. Questions about science and also even evolution have become increasingly common as part of sort of the ideological battle between progressives and conservatives, your view on these issues. So they will certainly be asked. But in terms of what voters typically decide on, there are some voters for whom these are key issues, and perhaps that's the case for Roger. But, you know, most polling data of what's the most important issue, it's always, you know, number one is the economy, number two, jobs, number three, healthcare, number four, foreign policy. Sometimes foreign policy bumps up. You typically get to the environment around number six or number seven. So it's an important part of the discussion. But it's typically not a central part of kind of the vote decision for a lot of voters. I can't say that about all voters, it's typically not the decisive issue. But it absolutely will be part of the discussion.
Well, and within a Republican primary, often questions on these topics tend to be provide a sort of shorthand for the ideological positioning
right.
of
for
the candidates within the field. And so, you know, this will come up. You know, right now, one thing that perhaps not shockingly, but one thing that is very conspicuous to me comparing what candidates are talking about now versus – and what voters are talking about now versus 4 years ago is to the extent that foreign policy is really uppermost on people's minds. 4 years ago, you talked to a lot of Republicans, and they were very leery of, engagement and entanglements abroad, and were sort of burnt out by Iraq and Afghanistan. But concerns now have led to, you know, a lot of hawkish talk on the trail that's, you know, being well received by the voters.
Which makes it tricky for Rand Paul, right, Josh, because he's seen as non-interventionist.
it'll be interesting to see what he says today when he's here. And he's slated to be the first candidate to really officially declare in early April. And, you know, he's been up here a lot. He has a ground organization that's here. He's, you know, a lot of the talk more recently has been about Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, but Rand Paul is right up there with him in a lot of the polling, and he's right up there with them in the polling in Iowa as well. So, there hasn't been a lot of talk about him lately, but certainly he's you know, in the mix in the top tier of candidates.
He gets a lot of attention when he comes. Yeah, yeah, Dean, I have another question for you.
Thinking about that list, you know, I think we pretty much are at a point where we have a good sense of what the field looks like on the Republican side. You know, John Kasich, the Ohio governor, one of the few wild cards left. He has the resume and kind of the success as governor that Republicans see him as a legitimate contender should he decide to get involved. I think he ran once before in 2000.
He did, not because a I remember interviewing him, yeah, actually.
Yeah,
and he was chair of the House Budget Committee.
Yeah, he's a former member of Congress and not a great campaign at that point, got out pretty early, but he's in a different position now politically than he was 15 years ago. So we're still kind of waiting to see just how interested he is. But he's someone who could shake up the field should he decide to get
in. Governor of a big politically diverse
state. Who's gotten elected in reasonable fashion in a state where, you know, he has to appeal to Democrats as well as Republicans.
Okay, two more questions on this, guys. One to you, Dean Spiliotis. Sure. Jeb Bush, in the national press, there's lots of talk about dynasty fatigue, that fair or not, Americans are uneasy about electing three presidents from the same family. How much do you hear about dynasty fatigue in the Granite State?
It always comes up. I've seen a number of interviews involving him during his visit, and he was asked consistently about, you know, the Bush family has a mixed record in New Hampshire. Is he concerned about that or Bush fatigue? You know, he's been very clear. He needs to kind of make his own case as an individual. It sort of is what it is. I mean, people either kind of had enough of the Bushes or they're okay with the idea of him as a candidate. But he's certainly trying hard to kind of distinguish himself from the rest of his family. And again, the Bush family, in terms of electoral success, it's been kind of mixed. He's approaching it from that perspective. But he has not, you know, he gets asked that all the time. And I think he's used to it at this point.
Well, okay. He also, I mean, the thinking among most Republicans is that this is a state in which Jeb Bush has to perform well. I mean, things can change, but I mean, the belief is that, you know, he's not necessarily a natural fit in Iowa, and, you know, he could do well in South Carolina and certainly Florida, but, you know, he needs a strong finish here and
to get to Florida, really.
And this is a place where the electorate, you know, might match up with him well. But as Dean said, this was not a state that was terribly friendly to his brother in the primary, and you know, his father lost the first time he ran in the primary. So, you know, he's obviously aware of that and says he's going to put in the time here.
All right. Well, gentlemen, and we have run out of time. I want to thank both of you for being here. Dean Spiliotis, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Sure thing. My pleasure, Laura.
And Josh Rogers, thanks for taking time out.
No problem, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR, checking in now with our Short March Fund Drive.